Hi, everybody. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to be here. I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous since December the 26th of 1981. For that, I'm very grateful. Don't tell you all I've been sober for. Well, actually, I thought I was sober for 27 years and a few months till the raffle started. Now I got another year of sobriety. Yeah, I'll tell you all I've been sober for 27 years to try to impress you, but I like to hear it myself because it just impresses the devil out of me, you know. I could stay sober for 27 hours, you know. 27, man, isn't that something? Think about it. 27 years, 28 years. There's a lot of sobriety in this room, man. And for a drunk to stay sober a week is a big deal. It's a big deal for a drunk to stay sober a week. But Faye and I are so very happy to be here. We've enjoyed every minute of it. We've been treated like kings, fed like pigs. I mean, you know, we'll gain 40 pounds before we leave here, you know. My cholesterol will be up through the roof, all these sweets and stuff. We appreciate it, Milton asking me to come, and the whole committee, and whoever's responsible for us being here, we sure want to thank you. Your hospitality has been wonderful, really. We really do appreciate being here. So, but now, you know, I'm here today to carry a message, and I don't take myself very seriously at all, but I take Alcoholics Anonymous serious as heart attack. You know? So I hope once I get started that I qualify myself for this program and elaborate and tell you the true side of what Faye touched on a little bit this morning. But more importantly, that I talk about recovery, because that's what I really love talking about. But invariably, I'll glance at my watch and I'll give myself a few minutes to qualify, and then I'll look back again and I got 5 or 6 minutes to tell you about recovery, because you get caught up in the drinking days, and I'm sure that'll probably happen this evening. But if you'll bear with me, I'd like to start off with a story that all of my stories I must tell you are true. So please keep that in mind. I don't tell jokes. These are true stories. I have a good friend of mine up in Cleveland, Ohio. I go to Cleveland, Ohio most every February for a men's workshop. And I got a good friend of mine up there. We go through the steps in a weekend every February, a bunch of guys, and at St. Joe's Retreat House. One of my buddies up there is a guy named Ben Hathcock, and Ben's a big kid, man. He's big enough to go bear hunting with a switch, and he owns and operates, or he did at the time, a construction company that essentially dug tunnels through solid rock along highways up there that provided drainage for highway systems. It was a tough job, and Ben was in the process of hiring people, and he was real busy one day and doing some interviewing, and this kid from Indiana came in and asked him for a job, and Ben glanced up and said, "I'll tell you what, kid, I'm awful busy today." He said, "You just tell me the toughest thing you ever did in your life, and if it meets the criterion of being tough, I'll hire you on the spot. You won't even have to fill out an app." And this kid said, "Well," he said, years ago when I was young back on the farm in Indiana, I was picking corn one fall, and the corn rollers got clogged up on the corn picker, and like a fool, I got off there and I started pulling on that corn to unclog them rollers, and the corn picker caught my right hand and it cut my right hand off right there." And he said, "I didn't panic." He said, "I just reached down in the mud and I picked up my right hand and I walked back to the house, and there wasn't anybody at home." He said, "And I just rinsed it off there in the kitchen sink, and I sat down there at the kitchen table and I took my mom's needle and thread and I sewed my own right hand back on." Ben said, "That's got to be the toughest thing I ever heard in my life." He said, "You got the job." And the kid said, "All right." Now, for those of you listening on tape, I'm not going to tell you what was so funny about that. He sewed his hand on upside down, and one thumb went up and one went down. One more quick story, if I may. Because I tell you what, if you've heard these stories, don't stop, because I want to hear them again. This boy seen an ad in the paper, said talking dog for sale. And wasn't any phone number, he just said talking dog. Man, that's incredible. So he goes across town, knocks on this guy's door and says, "Y'all got a dog for sale that talks?" He said, "Yeah, he's tied up in the backyard, go talk to him." So he walked through this guy's house kind of sheepish, walked out there, his mutt tied up there in the backyard. He walked up to him and says, "Do you really talk?" And the dog said, "Yeah, I talk." He said, "But I just talk English. That's the only language I know." Well, that's incredible. I said, what's your story? He said, "Well," he said, "not this guy that owned me, but the guy that owned me before, when he found out that I understood English," he said, "he worked for the federal government. He got me a job as an undercover agent for the federal government. And I just hung out at the airport, and it's absolutely amazing the things that you learn when people don't know you know how to talk, just by sitting and listening," he said. "And then I got in some overseas assignments. I've got two or three presidential citations about some things that if I told you about, I'd have to kill you." And he said, "And then I finally got married, had some pups, and retired. And I don't do much of anything anymore." He said, "That is absolutely the most incredible thing I've ever heard in my life." He said, "Well, it's nice talking with you." "Yeah, nice talking to you." And he goes back inside and he says, "Are you sure you want to sell that dog?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I'm ready to get rid of him." He said, what do you want for a dog like that?" He said, "Oh, I don't know. $10. $10 for a dog? Why so cheap?" "That daggone dog's a liar. He didn't do none of that stuff." Well, I'm here to tell a story of recovery, and I'm going to start that now. But if you would bear with me once more, there's a prayer that I've been using to start my lead and or my talk, and I'd like to say that prayer. I've got it written down here, so I'm going to read it if I can get through it. It always touches my heart. God bless all the alcoholics wherever they may be. Bless those unfortunate who are in most need of sobriety. Look upon them with compassion and mercy, and lead them onto this wonderful fellowship, that only through you it may help them as it has helped us and thousands of others. Bless those who are sober today. Give grace to those who are on their way. That God please show compassion and mercy to those who may never arrive. Amen. I was born in 1944 in southwestern Indiana to a blue-collar family. My dad had been a combat veteran of World War II in the South Pacific. And when he came home, they gave him 5 years to live because of some diseases that he'd contacted down there, and they missed that 5 years by about 6 weeks. My dad died when I was 5 years old, and it broke my spirit. I remember that vividly, you know, as if it were yesterday, you know. And I was going to live the rest of my life in that little town called Linton, Indiana, in southwestern Indiana. I knew it by the time I had cousins there and family there. All my people were there. My grandparents, my great-grandparents were buried in a cemetery in the country not far away. My roots were deep in that area, and I knew that that's where I had no plans at all. And all of a sudden, my dad was dead, and my mom found a guy that I didn't like and remarried and drug us a couple of hundred miles across the state. And I grew up in east central Indiana, in Wayne County. Richmond, Indiana is where I grew up. And when I look back on that episode of my life, it was the defining moment of my life. I guess we all have benchmarks, but that certainly was the benchmark of my life when my dad died. This marks, I think, this July will be, he's been dead 60 years, and, you know, I'm not over it yet, you know. It's just kind of used to the idea, but you don't get over it. I grew up in the country out in Wayne County, Indiana, as I said, pretty much on my own. I had a stepfather and a mother and three sisters, but the phrase that I've heard often repeated in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't feel like I fit in there at all, you know. I went to a small school in rural Indiana back before schools were reconsolidated, and every township had a school. There were 19 kids that started with me in the first grade, and essentially the same 19 kids graduated when we graduated high school some years later. And you know what? Even though that was such a small and intimate setting, I didn't feel like I fit in there at all. As Faye talked about earlier, we were associated with an extremely conservative church at that time, and my mom, it was one of them kind of churches and religious organizations that, you know, you go to church meetings like 480 times a week. And everything you do revolves around it. Everything, everybody you know is associated with it. And if you drift outside that, then you're outside the hierarchy and you're frowned upon, and everything you do is confined to that kind of activity. And no matter what it was I was doing, or no matter where it was, I still had that pervasive feeling of not fitting in. There were good people in that church. They were solid, good, honest, hardworking people who tried their best to live by Christian principles. And I'll be honest, I wanted to be that way. I really did. I tried to be that way. But I found there were a lot of rules. Did y'all church have a lot of rules? Have you noticed drunks and rules don't get along? Have you ever noticed that? We don't do rules real good, you know? You ask me to do something? Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir, I'll be glad to. You tell me to do something? You know? Faith says, would you do the dishes today? Well, yes, babe, I'll be glad to. You're going to do the dishes today. You think so, huh? That's just the way we are, you know? Well, all these rules, and I took things literally, and I was having a hard time. I was grinding, and I'm grinding on the inside. I'm grinding at school. I'm grinding at home. I'm grinding in this church house. I'll give you an example of why I was having so much problem. There was a guy like me standing up here like, I love this word. He was pontificating, whatever that means, you know. He's preaching, you know. And this is what he said. This is what I heard him say. There's a big difference in there, what you hear and what's said. This is what I heard him say. If you think about doing something bad, as far as God's concerned, you might as well have already done it. And I thought, oh my God, I raped 100 women this week. Oh, Lord of mercy. I stabbed my sister to death, skinned him alive, made his lampshade out of it. I took that serious. I said, I can't live. Man, I can't. If you think, you just think about it. If it just crosses your mind in God's eyes, it's, oh man. Well, so here I am, and then I had some hoodlum friends, you know, what I called hoodlum friends that I run with, that did things that I found unconscionable. You know, them guys that, you know, back then stole hubcaps and broke into the grain elevator and stole money out of the pop machines and stuff like that. And I like to hang around the peripheral of that stuff, you know, but I couldn't be that kind. I couldn't do that kind of stuff. I didn't have the conscience that allowed me to do that sort of. They seemed to enjoy it and get by with it, but I always liked being around that stuff, you know, and watching them do it. Got great pleasure and satisfaction from being around them hoodlum guys. But you know what? I didn't feel like I fit in there. So here I'm stuck, you know. I'm over here with. I don't feel like I fit in the goods, and I can't be good and I can't be bad. And you know what? The bottom line of the matter is that I am best described by Dr. Silkworth in the description of the alcoholic, in his opinion, where Bill had said, what's your opinion of this thing? And in our book, where he says, men and women like us are restless, and irritable, and discontented. And I like to add bored. Irritable, restless, irritable, discontented, and bored with life. And then this 15-year-old kid, in the summer of 1959, discovered the magic. You know what the magic was. The pomp is the different, but the circumstances are the same, or the circumstances are different, the pomp, but you know what? Every drunk story is the same. Along comes that wonderful time when you first experience the feeling produced by alcohol. Mine happened when I was 15 years old. I'm in my step-grandparents' house. I'm sitting on the side of their bed. One Saturday afternoon, I'm looking down that closet and I spy a case. I'm talking a case of Granddad 86-proof bourbon whiskey. A case, and only one, that's right, and only one bottle had been opened. And I looked down in there and I reached in that open bottle, and the cork had already been, the seal was broken, and the whiskey was down about that far in the neck. I pulled the cork out of that bottle and I took the first drink of whiskey in my life. And two things happened to me. I love the taste of warm whiskey. I still savor the taste. Some people say they had to hold their nose to drink it. Oh, no, not me. I love the taste of warm whiskey right out of the bottle. And I started toking on that bottle. And the second thing, this most important thing, the second most defining moment of my life, I fell in love with the feeling produced by alcohol. I fell in love with that feeling. That's the reason I drank it. As time went on, that's the reason I continued to drink right then, and it's the reason I took the last drink of whiskey I took, because I loved the feeling produced by alcohol. Life sucked. Didn't I just tell you that? There was no place I felt comfortable. No place. I didn't figure I was going to make it to 17 anyway. That's about as old as I figured I'd live. And all of a sudden, life was so intolerable. There, that Saturday afternoon, life was acceptable. That feeling that it produced made life acceptable. And from that moment on, I describe that, and I've heard it described by others, as being so brief, that feeling, so elusive, that I call it the 8 minutes. I don't know for you how long that feeling lasts, but for me, I call it it might be longer, it might be shorter, but it didn't last long enough, obviously. But I would do anything, go anywhere, do anything for the 8 minutes. I would do anything for the feeling produced by alcohol from that moment on. Was I alcoholic right then and there? I don't know. I don't know nothing about this. I don't know when, I don't know when you cross the line. And if I had stopped right then, I would have never become an alcoholic, obviously. Stop? Are you kidding me? I haven't even got started. Stop? Are you kidding me? Well, now, I drank that fifth of whiskey. For all intent and purposes, the first time I ever drank whiskey in my life, I drank a fifth of it. Well, I'm a rookie at that time, and rookies don't get by with drinking whiskey like that. It made me deathly sick. You can imagine, 15-year-old kid. My mom thought I had food poisoning. I don't know how I got by with not, but, well, the other thing, my grandmother that afternoon asked me if I wanted to have a bowl of ice cream after I drank all that whiskey. I love vanilla ice cream, so I didn't know any difference. I said, sure, So I had a bunch of vanilla ice cream on the top of a fifth of whiskey. You can imagine how long it, it took me 3 days to get over that drunk. It was a Saturday afternoon. It was like Wednesday before I was back vertical, I was green, man. I thought I was going to have to get better to die. And now you think about this. And any rational, and we use the word insanity in this program. And right there, the second step, the basic foundation of the second step is being laid in my life. The insanity of this program is not the stupid things that we do while we're drinking. The insanity of AA is thinking that next time I drink, it's going to be different. And you think about anybody that rationally looks at alcohol and the feeling that it produces and what the ramifications of drinking it, after the first experience you have of it, you get sick and you stay sick for 3 days to the point you can't do anything. Most people would say, Lord have mercy, I ain't never doing that no more. Mm-mm. I am not doing that ever again. That was the worst thing ever. But me, you know what I thought? Long round Thursday? I'm going to do that next chance I get. But I'm just not going to eat any ice cream after. Yeah. And I think maybe if I could just get down around a quarter of that butt jug instead of the whole jug, because I remember I started feeling good after about 3 sips of it. And really, isn't that all we wanted? Just to take the edge off. I didn't want to get rip-roaring drunk. And I'm thinking, I'm going to do that again. The insanity of alcoholism had entered my life as a 15-year-old kid. Well, obviously, I didn't have access to nor the ability to drink every day at that moment. As we say, this is a progressive illness. I'm going to tell you, every chance I got, I'm looking for the 8 minutes, because that's the secret to life. That's the secret to happiness. That's just about the only time I feel any happiness or joy in my life or tranquility. So I'm looking for that every 8 minutes, every chance I get. So what do? You hang around with guys who are looking for the 8 minutes too, And you stop hanging around with quality people who are looking to maybe better themselves and set some goals for themselves and have some sort of ambition, because when you're looking at the 8 minutes, it's an all-consuming activity for me. Alcoholism for me is a full-time job. So you lay educational and economic and any other goals that I might have had, which I didn't anyway probably, I lay them aside because I'm constantly looking for the 8 minutes. I graduated from high school in 1982. It was kind of a big event in our family, you know, because I was the first person in my family to graduate from high school. You know, I liked school, you know. I didn't feel like I fit in, but, you know, the happiest 4 years of my life was the seventh grade, you know. I liked some of them kids I went to school with. We still get together every once in a while, you know. It's creeping up near 50 years now, but we... But we still get together, and we were almost like family at the time. But as I said earlier, I didn't feel like I fit in. But I graduated from high school in 1962. My mom had my uncles and a bunch of people over to the house, and for me graduating, gave me some nice things, you know. And I remember folks asking me what plans I had for the future, and I'm sure I was pretty good about telling you what I was going to do, you know. But you know what? I was thinking to myself, for the future, I don't even know what I'm going to do tomorrow. You know, because the thing about me was that with all this grinding that I just, this emotional distress that was going on inside of me, with all that inability to emotionally just put my left foot in front of my right and to try to become a mature young adult, with all that grinding and all that mess that was going on, and me constantly looking for outside ways to find that relief from that mental anguish that I felt, if you were to meet me, you would have absolutely no idea in any of that was going on. I had the ability to put on a face that you would not believe. I am on top of the world. This is a crackerjack person, and I am just fine. Thank you very much. I had the ability to do that. And I thought that's what you all were doing. I'm going to tell you, it takes a lot of energy to put on that act, and that's what it was. And I looked out at you, and you guys looked like you were doing just fine. You looked like you were just bebopping through life, and here I am grinding. I'm having a hard... And what I know now is I was comparing your outsides with my inside. I was looking at how you looked like you felt, comparing it to the way I really felt. And it wasn't a very good way to compare things. And I was not growing up on the inside at all, because every time I had anything that I didn't need, anything that distressed me, I'm jumping in that whiskey jug as fast as I can, or anything else I could find to drink, as you'll find out later. I became less and less particular as time went on. In January, I believe it was, of 1964, I met Faith through a friend of mine that she was dating at the time. And that was in January of 64, and in September of 1965, we got married. You know, just kids. And in July of the next year, our daughter Michelle was born. And now look at this, look at me. Here I am, 22 years old, and I am a husband and a father. And I don't even know how to be a son. Nor a brother. I was on my way to California in a $100 Chevrolet, and I stopped in Indianapolis to see my grandparents, and one of my uncles said, "What are you doing?" And I told him, he said, "Would you be interested in a job out at the plant?" And he worked at the Chrysler plant in Indianapolis, and I said, "Yeah, they pay pretty good, don't they?" I said, "Yeah." So he made a phone call, and he got me a job at the Chrysler plant. I got my first paycheck, and I thought, if I work here 6 weeks, I can buy California. I'm making more money than the old man, you know. I wound up staying 30 years, you know. But now listen, have you ever worked in a factory? It's boring. And you know something about it? They want you there every day. On time, in the middle of the night. You know? It's boring. It's hot. You know? You do the same thing every day. Some old man told me when I first started in, he said, "Son, don't get no better than this. That's it." So my wife and I and my daughter, we moved into a half double on 34th Street in Indianapolis. Here I am, a husband and a father. Do you know something? Did you know that a gas bill comes every month? And the rent lady, the landlady live across the street in the half a double over there that she rents across the street, if I ain't right on Johnny on the spot paying that rent, she's beating on my door. Where's my rent money? Well, I'm a little short right now. I don't care. They want it, right? You know what I'm talking about is responsibility. You know, it just scared me to death. Rent, you know, you got to have a car payment and all that stuff. You got this job that you hate going into. You're working with a bunch of mental midgets. Man, it's tough. Life is tough. You know what I'm doing every chance I get? I'm jumping in that whiskey jug. I'm looking for that 8 minutes because, you know, if you don't know where you are, you don't mind being there. You know, so I'm drinking, and back then they didn't care if you drank on the job. So I'm drinking on the way to work, I'm drinking at work, I'm drinking on the way home, I'm drinking at home. You know, it just, like I said, it's a progressive illness, you know. I bought my first bottle of whiskey in Indianapolis off a bootlegger in the plant, you know. And them's the guys I hung around with. The guys that popped the top on a half pint of whiskey at 9 o'clock in the morning, poured a little bit in their coffee and slugged the rest of it down. You know, that's the kinds. And here I am, I'm 22 years old, and I'm hanging right with them guys who wind up dying at age 43 of cirrhosis of the liver, you know. And I thought those guys had it all together. Those are the guys I hung around with. And instead of coming home, I'm stopping at every blue-collar tavern on the east side of Indianapolis because I love that kind of stuff. I love the guys in there. I love the, you know, it's the closest thing to fitting in I ever felt in my life. You know, this episode that Faye described earlier, I'm gonna tell you about this episode a little bit because Faye did ask me one morning. We had moved to a new house up in the suburbs, bought a new house. We thought that helps. Yeah, that helps a great deal, and it slowed my drinking down for 12 minutes, maybe 15. We bought this new house up there, you know, and everything, you know, we had all the stuff, all the props, you know, got a nice house, got the yard. I'm paying somebody to come out there and put the fertilizer on the grass so it's green like all these other stupid, idiotic neighbors I got, you know. Got to have green grass, you know, can't have one dandelion in it. I got a fairly nice car, you know, I'm making decent money. I'm working in a union shop, making decent money, and, you know, sometimes I'll even go to work every day on time. And Faye works too, and so we've got a decent income, and we've got all the props. You know, everything looks like it's in together, but behind closed doors, it wasn't together at all. You know, that's where the manifestation of my alcoholism happened in my home behind closed doors. Because on the streets and at the shop, man, and in the taverns, I'm good time Charlie Potatoes. I got this act on. I got this thing going on. You know, and I hope I'm not that way today. But anyway. They asked me one. It's funny now. We tell sad stories and people laugh, you know. She said, "Mike, can you come home sober tonight?" And you know what I said? Why? Now think about that. First off, she said, "One night out of seven, can you come home sober this night?" And I'm thinking to myself, what possibly could be so important that I have to be here sober, you know? And she told me about the kid coming up from the old neighborhood. And she was a crackerjack kid. This little girl had been born with one arm and only one leg. But, man, her parents just, man, they were super. That little girl would go off a 40-foot platform dive like nothing, man. She would do everything, ride a bike, swim, everything. She was a wonderful kid and impressive kid. But anyway, I said, yeah, I remember her. She's a good kid. She said, well, she's coming up here tonight. And, Mike, they come from a good family, and they've never seen anybody like you drunk before, you know. Okay. So, what time do you want me here? She said, how about being here around 5 o'clock? I said, baby, I get off at 3:30. I got plenty of time. So, I'm going to tell y'all something. When I left that house that morning, I had to be there like at 6:30, so I'm leaving the house like at 5:45 at 5:30, whenever it was. Had a pretty good drive. I would have bet my house I'd have been home by 5 o'clock. I had every intention in this world of being there by 5 o'clock. Instead of going down to Bob's Silver Dollar Bar at lunch and having my lunch down there and getting my check cashed, I walked over to the bank and got my check cashed. And I did not drink that day at lunchtime like I did every other day, you know, because I have every intention of being home by 5 o'clock. I'm standing in the time clock line, and it's 3:28. I would have bet my car I'm on home. I got in that car, and I started up, and that keen alcoholic mind kicked in. Have you got a keen alcoholic mind? I've got one. And that keen alcoholic mind said, look at that fool. You got an hour and a half. Only takes you like 45 minutes to drive home. You got plenty of time for one. Yeah. And if you don't stop down at the hideaway, the boys will wonder where you're at. They'll be thinking something's happened to you. So instead of turning right and going home, you know what I did? I turned left and I headed down to the tavern. And the barmaid, Beverly, when she seen my car pull in the parking lot, she had that first beer sitting right there already open. And I walk in there and my beer was already, it made me feel important. It made me feel like somebody. You ever have a barmaid know you that well? And then Beverly, my barmaid, who was later convicted of killing her boyfriend and cutting him into a bunch of pieces and distributing him around Indiana in the lakes and rivers. My good friend Beverly says, Mike, would you like a shot with that? And I said, Beverly, that is a crackerjack idea. So she poured me a shot of that cheap whiskey, and I drink it, you know, and wash it down with that cold beer. And, hey, man, it's hot in that plant. Man, it's, you know, if you worked in a plant, you'd deserve a drink too, man. Boring. Working for that foreman that's a mental midget. And you know what? I got time for one more, ain't I? Oh, yeah, I got plenty of time. Yeah, I have another one. Yeah, pour me a shot, too. That's what I drink, shots and beers in the blue-collar taverns on the east side of Indianapolis. And I drink another one. Get my buddies one here, will you? I got plenty of money, so I didn't drink at lunch. So I got a little extra cash, you know? Huh? So I got plenty of time, you know? I'll have another one. And I got to get home by 5 o'clock. Holy Toledo, look at that. It's almost 9 o'clock. What happened? Oh, well, she's already hot. This keen alcoholic mind kicks in and says, you know what? My wife is probably right now mad as she can possibly get. And right now it don't matter if I come home right this second and call her and tell her something's happened, or if I wait till 3 weeks from Wednesday, it ain't going to be no different. And so I just go home when I wanted to, you know, or ran out of money probably. And I had lost my shirt to this day. I haven't an idea where it was. I had my jacket on, but I probably puked on my shirt or something, you know. And I walk in that house, and Faye was so disgusted with me. And that little Elkie, bless her heart, she hadn't never seen nobody like me. She was, you know, totally astonished. My daughter was disgusted. And I couldn't understand, why are they all upset with me? I didn't intend for that to happen. I did not intend that to happen at all. I didn't do this on purpose. Remember, I left the house that morning with the best intentions in the world. I'm going to be here at 5 o'clock. I sat there at noon, and I didn't go to the tavern. I intended to go home. When I got to the time clock, I intended to go home. When I got to the tavern, I intended only to have a couple. And here I am wondering why. You know what it is? I was judging myself by my intentions. And Faye was judging me by my actions. They're light years apart. They were light years apart. Well, a lot of them nights that I'd come home in that condition, you may not believe it. You see Faye's a pretty passionate person, you know what I mean? We don't have any little, she calls them debates, you know, we don't have little debates, you know. She'd get up in my, you can't believe it, she'd get up in my face about my drinking. Oh, yeah, right in my face about my drinking. It's none of her business. I ain't hurting her, none of her business. Get out of my face, girl, you know. She said, Mike, do you know how much money you spent this week on just right here I've seen you spend? I don't care. I don't care. This, I don't do anything else. Don't you understand? This is what I do. I don't play golf. I don't bowl. I don't have a hobby. I don't go hunting. This is what I do. I'm a professional drinker. You know? I did. I felt I had given up my amateur standing when I started drinking on Sundays. I'd done that years ago. I drink. This is what I do. Get out of my face. And most of the nights, she would get out of my face. But some nights, she wouldn't get out of my face. One word would lead to another, and one push would lead to a shove. And then all of a sudden, man, we didn't have shoving matches. We had knockdown, drag-out fights in our house. We had guns going off. We had knives being pulled. We had furniture busted up. We had glass being broken. We had holes in the wall. We had cops at the house. Over, not once or twice, but on a regular, ongoing basis for 14 or 16 years of our married life where active alcoholism was there. Cops would come to the house, you know, ask me, you know, you ever have pack-up drilled your house? You want pack-up drill? I can put everything I need in two glad garbage bags, man, and be out of my house in 2 minutes. You know, I roar out, throw that stuff in the back of the car and roar out of the driveway and get down at the stop sign. It dawned on me, you know, where am I going? I got no place to go, you know. You can go some flea bag motel for a day or two, you know, and then drag your sorry can back home, you know, feeling like a slug. And you feel so, you know, you feel, I don't care, you know, you feel so bad about this stuff and so full of remorse and guilt and the pain and the anguish that comes in there. And then you reach for that whiskey bottle and it takes it all away. Reach for that whiskey jug and that 8 minutes takes all those feelings away. But you come back and you make them apologies, you know. Baby, I'm sorry about that. You know, I didn't mean to do that. You know, if I hadn't been drinking, you know what? I'll tell you what, I am really going to start watching. I am not going to drink as much as I have been. You know, and I meant it. I meant it. But all the time I was saying that, I'm thinking to myself, you know what? It's just a matter of time. If I make it a month, or if I make it maybe 6 weeks before I blow up again, I'll be doing good. And I knew it when I was apologizing. It's just a matter of time. Finally, in August of 1980, after 16 years of active alcoholism, my wife, due to a series of circumstances that she touched on today, made a decision that the Al-Anon family groups called. They have a book entitled Courage to Change, and my wife didn't know it, but that's what it was. She had a courage to change. She was not going to watch me kill myself and let my daughter grow up in that environment anymore. My daughter was 14 at the time, I believe. And my wife had took a change of clothes and my daughter, and she took off. Well, we had done all that before, had to pack up drills and had to, but there was just something about the finality of that particular episode that just stabbed me in the heart this time. I loved my wife, and I loved my daughter, and I did not have an inkling as to how to show it. I did not know how to show it. It was all about me. 99% of alcoholism is manifest in me in selfishness and self-centeredness. And I didn't know how to show it. And now I want to show it and I can't show it. So that was what precipitated me to go to my first A&A meeting, you know. I talked to the employee assistance rep at work. He encouraged me to go to my first meeting. So on August the 6th of 1980, I drove 35 miles south to Indianapolis to this meeting. Pouring rain, man, like it's been raining here all weekend. Pouring rain. Walked up to that door three times before I had enough gumption to open the door and walk inside to this small speaker meeting there at this Ford Union Hall on the southeast side of Indianapolis. And I sat down there, you know, and I don't remember the details of the meeting. I remember it was a speaker meeting. But I do remember this. I remember looking up at the ceiling tiles and thinking to myself, this sucks donkey snot. I would rather drink a cup of ice-cold donkey snot than be here. And I'm counting the ceiling tiles, you know, let me see, there's 12 this way, and there's 18 that way, 12 times, you know, this is where my mind is, you know. And this guy's up here talking, and I'm sitting there with jeans got puke stains on them and holes in the knees, and I got puke stains on my shoes, I noticed, because I threw up a lot. I was a puking drunk. And he's sitting there talking about, and he lived in a fancy apartment in north side of Indianapolis. He'd been a salesman all of his life and was quite well educated, and I could not relate to one thing he was talking about from his background, just from that standpoint. But about 5 minutes before he ended his talk, he started talking about feelings, and one of the things he talked about was fear and the fact that he'd lived most of his adult life in fear. And I'm going to tell you all something. I had never in my life heard an adult man admit he was afraid of anything, because where I came from, that was a sign of weakness, and you did not tell anybody you were afraid. You could be shaking in your boots, but you wouldn't tell anybody that. And this guy, and I had lived in fear all of my life, alcoholic fear of impending doom all of my life. And that pricked my interest, that a guy, I mean, right out in front of God and everybody would talk about being afraid, you know. So that was a Wednesday night. There was no meetings around on Thursday where I live, so Friday night I went to the meeting closer to my home, And it too was a speaker meeting. I sat through that. And after the meeting, a couple of fellows came up and said, "Hey, would you like to go get your new day AA?" I said, "Yes, second meeting. Would you like to go get some coffee?" And I thought, here it comes. Here's the deal. Now I get it. Yeah. $299 down and $29 a month, you know. That's what, they're going to hook me over here. I said, "I haven't got 29 cents in my pocket, so they're not getting nothing from me, you know." So I go over and we sit down to coffee shop and start talking. They let me bellyache for a couple hours and they share a little bit about what AA has done in their life. And they talk at length about their recovery till past midnight. And they've both got families waiting for them at home, and I don't. And when we got up to leave, they said, "We'll get that." And they picked up the tab for the coffee. And that impressed me. That got my attention. That was the first time, because you know what those two guys did? They gave of themselves, and they didn't ask for anything back. They gave of themselves just briefly, and they didn't ask me for nothing. And that impressed me. So that got my interest up, and I went to a meeting on Sunday night. And I got up and I went to work on Monday, and I went to work on Tuesday, and it dawned on me, I've been sober a week. I swear to God, I haven't had nothing for a week. That's the reason I said earlier, being sober, if you're a drunk and you're sober for a week, that's a big deal. That was a big deal for me to go a week without drinking. I hadn't gone a week in 17, 18 years without being drunk. And to manage to get a week's sobriety, that was a big deal. And right then and right there, I didn't know how, I didn't know anything about it, but I had this sensation there was power in the rooms of AA. I sensed the power in the rooms, and I didn't know how to plug into that power, but I knew that power was there. So and Faye had, by this time, I couldn't live at home. We had all the court stuff going on, and I'm living with some dope peddling buddies of mine down 42nd and Kittley, which is not a very good area of Indianapolis even back then. It's worse now. They're selling dope out of the one room, and I'm reading the big book in the other. And it dawned on me, you know, if the cops come in here, they're not going to believe this. They are not going to believe I'm not part of this deal. So I got my own little place, you know, and got out of there. And I'm going to AA meetings. And like Faye said earlier today, my Aunt Peggy went to bat for me, bless her heart. You know, and I didn't know she was going to. She made Faye feel guilty, and Faye called me up and asked me if I'd come back home. And I said, "Oh yeah, man." I'm thinking, look at this, man. This A&A works, man. I ain't been sober no time. Look out there, jump back, man. I'm back in the big bed, man. Be sleeping on no filthy couch, you know. I'm back in the big bed, and I ain't been sober no time. I'm going to A&A meetings, and I'm not drinking, and I hear this phrase around the rooms, you know, if you don't drink and you keep coming, things get better. Have you ever heard that? Don't drink, keep coming back, things get better. I hear it repeated a lot. Well, I'm doing that. I'm going to meetings, you know, and I'm not drinking. You know, things got back. And I got, you know, I got paid my first paycheck in sobriety. And I asked this guy next to me, I asked this slug, I said, "Hey, did we get a raise?" He said, "No, fool." I said, "You worked 40 hours." Wow, we make pretty good money, don't we? Yeah, if you're here. You know? Now I'm not drinking. I got more money. I got money back in my pocket, you know. Faye's got me back at home. Got my daughter, you know. She's barely talking to me, but we're talking. Things are going smooth, man. I'm going to these meetings. I'm going, not drinking. But I don't know nothing about AA. I'm just attending meetings. And I'm not drinking. Well, here's the message I want you to listen to. Going to AA meetings and not drinking did not treat my alcoholism. Think about that. Going to AA meetings and not drinking did not treat. It's kind of like going to a PTA meeting thinking that make you a parent. There was more, but I didn't, because every once in a while, and then not so every once in a while, you would use the G word, you know, that God word would come out. And the instant that you said God, you know what my mind would do? My mind in a millisecond would race back to the God of my mother's understanding, where that guy standing up here pontificating about me thinking about doing something bad, I might as well do it. I'm going to tell y'all something. I don't want no part of that. I want no part of that. Thank you very much. So I'm not going to do nothing if it's got God involved. I did not realize what you were telling me. I didn't hear that part of it. I'm going to meetings, and I'm not drinking, and by God, that's good enough. Isn't that the bottom line? If you're sober, isn't that the deal? And that, I mean, that's what, you know, if I'm not drinking, I can do anything I want to do. So I'm sitting in these meetings, and I'm not, you know what happened to me? I got restless, irritable, and discontented, and bored with A&A. You guys realize you say the same things over and over and over. I went to this group on Wednesday night called the Dillman Group in Indianapolis in the basement of a church down there at 10th and Ritter. I'd go down there and they have them donuts, like four-day-old donuts are like hard as bricks. They got that lousy coffee. And I'm sitting there one night and I'm thinking, got this keen alcoholic mind thinking. And I'm thinking, look at these slugs, man. These people ain't drinking. And they like it. They're sober and they like it. How do they do that? Because right now, I'm going to tell y'all something. I was at a point in my life, I will give you $10,000 for a pint of whiskey if I can drink it and get by with it. I'm sitting in an AA meeting, and I am so thirsty, I will give you $25,000 for a half pint of whiskey if I can drink it and get by with it. But my wife's already told me I can't drink it and get by with it. I bet there's something in them donuts. I bet there's something. I'm going to try it. Maybe that's it. There's something in them. So I give me some of that coffee, and I give me one of them bricks, and I'm softening it up so I can gum it down, you know. And somebody slaps me on the back and said, Mike, how you doing? Hey, I'm doing fine. Hey, how you doing? Good to see you. Great. I'm doing great. Oh, yeah. Got a pint in the car. I'll give you $4 million for it. Faith told me that if I start drinking again, she's going to kick me out. And for the first time in my life, I'm thinking about sneaking drinking. I've never snuck a drink in my life. I've been so open and brazen about it. Everybody in my family, everybody at work, everybody I drank with knew Mike's a drinker, man. He drinks a lot of whiskey. He will drink more whiskey than anybody you know. And now my mind is raised. But if I start drinking whiskey, I do not want to live at 42nd and Kittley on a filthy mattress, you know, with my dope-pushing buddies. And that's what was... So this keen alcoholic mind kicked in. You know, I got a keen. You got a keen alcoholic mind? I got one. Oh, man. And the wheels start spinning. And I thought, you know, I heard this lead one time where this guy said when he, back in Indiana, not too many years ago, you couldn't buy anything alcoholic on Sunday. I mean, nothing. Nowhere, no, there wasn't, it's changed, but you could not buy anything. And he said sometimes when he would run out, he would drink mouthwash or aftershave lotion. And I thought, well, that stuff's got to taste like sheep dip. I don't think I could drink that. I'll tell you what. I'm sitting there one Thursday night at my house, and Faith's still at work, and I'm feeling sorry for myself, you know, because I can't drink. I want to drink so badly. I'm going to meetings, and I'm not drinking, and I want to drink so badly because I've taken no positive, affirmative action on the steps. That's the reason I felt that way. Nothing. I haven't for sure even taken the first step. So that guy said mouthwash. So I looked in Faye's cabinet, and she had some of that brown Listerine mouthwash. And I looked at that label, and this keen alcoholic mind calculated that it was 42 proof. It said the primary ingredient is ethyl alcohol. Well, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I know I like ethyl alcohol. I love ethyl alcohol. Now, that kind you can't pronounce that you rub on your body, I can't pronounce that kind. That kind will kill you. I know that. But this is ethyl alcohol. Have you ever noticed the top of a Listerine jar looks like a shot glass? I poured a shot of that, and I was right about one thing. It tastes like sheep did. And I could hardly choke it down. But I choked down three shooters of that stuff sitting there in that bathroom. And I thought, you know what, that fool lied to me because there ain't nothing there. And I got up and, man, there it was. There was that wonderful, warm, comfortable, elusive 8 minutes. And I thought I had discovered the nectar of the gods. How smart I am. This keen alcoholic mind had figured it out. My wife, well, haven't a clue that I am drinking. How could she know? my breath is going to be the sweetest one in the county. And I can go to the meetings. Those clowns won't know I'm drinking. You know? And I'm only going to need like three shots a day. You know, you come home, take three shots of this, just take the edge off. That was on Thursday night. The following Monday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Monday, 4 days later, I'm standing at the drugstore across from where I work, and I got 2-quart bottles of Listerine, one in each hand. I'm back again the next day with 2 quarts of Listerine. I'm back the next day. Now I'm going down to 21st and Arlington because I don't want these fools thinking I'm drinking this stuff, you know. 2 quarts is a half a gallon, isn't it? I'm drinking a half a gallon of mouthwash every day. You believe that? I did it for over 9 months. It tastes funky. I mean, there's nothing that... And then this keen alcoholic mind said, you know what, you ought to mix it with something. So I tried mixing it with everything. Water, soda, Pepsi Cola, Coca-Cola, 7-Up, milk, anything, man. And nothing made it any more palatable than just forcing it down out of the bottle, you know. But you know what? It provided me with that relief, that 8 minutes that I absolutely depended upon and had to have. I could not live, I could not accept life on life's terms, and I needed that 8 minutes. And I'll find it in a Chivas Regal at $40 or $50 a bottle, or I'll find it for 79 cents in a bottle of Listerine. That's how badly this drunk will go after the 8 minutes. I will do anything, drink anything, go anywhere, give up anything if I feel I have to for the 8 minutes. I'm driving down the street one day not far from my house in my car. I'm drunk on this Listerine. I got an open bottle of it between my legs. I turn the corner too quick and I spill that jug and it's gurgling out in the passenger side and I nearly wrecked my car trying to save 79 cents worth of mouthwash. And I grabbed hold of that, you know, and about half of it was gone and popped my head on the mirror as I looked up, put a big gash in my head. And I looked at myself and I thought, Michael, look at you, man. You have got a problem with alcohol. Look at what you're doing. Look at this, man. Well, it took that for this keen alcoholic to reach what we call our bottom. I looked in that mirror and I saw a zero looking back, an absolute zero. And on December the 26th of 1981, I couldn't hold any more Listerine, so I bought a couple of bottles of Schnapps, and then I bought some whiskey, and then I did it upright, and then I passed out in the bathroom like Faye described. And the following Tuesday, I went back to the group that, actually, I went back Sunday night, I believe it was. And my friend Charlie G. was standing, he's dead now. My good buddy Charlie Gibson was standing there, and he said something to me, and I saw Charlie. I said, man, I've been drinking. He said, I've been drinking for quite a while. And you know what Charlie did to me? He didn't get mad at me. He didn't get angry with me. He didn't call me names, told me how stupid I was. Charlie Gibson put his arm around me, hugged my neck. He said, Mike, that's what drunks do. We get drunk. That's our natural state. It is unnatural for us to be sober. It is unnatural for us to be sober. Don't beat up yourself. He hugged my neck again. He said, won't you come back over Tuesday night, your home group, and get the beginner's token. We give him tokens out for beginners. So I did that. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous this time with my hat in my hand and with a new resolve. I had made a resolve to myself, I am not going to die a drunk man. I don't know how it's going to work, I don't know what I have to do, but I would do anything. And I walked up to a guy that I swore I would never, ever ask. And I asked that man for help. But I didn't say, will you help me? You know, guys like me, we don't ask nobody for help. No, it's not in our vocabulary. We can't do it. You know what I asked him as I was looking at my shoes? I said, Rex, would you be my sponsor? But that's what we do when we ask for that. We were asking for help. And he, you know what he said? I hadn't thought about this for long. You know what he told me? The first words out of his mouth. He said, Mike, I've been praying to God that you'd ask me. I've been praying to God that you would ask me. And then he changed. He said, what would you do to get what we have? And I looked back and I said, I'll do anything. And if he had said, we're going to walk tomorrow morning, I want you to meet me over here in Noblesville. Tomorrow morning, we're going to walk around the world to get you sober. You know what I would have told him? Can I call Faye and tell her I'm going to be gone a while? I'd have walked around the world. I do not like closed spaces, what do you call it, being claustrophobic. You know, when you get in them, I don't like that. I found that out when I had a CAT scan here not long ago. I don't like that at all. But you know what, if that man said, you know what, Mike, we're going to take you down in a coal mine down southwestern Indiana. We're going to stay down there for a couple of weeks in that coal mine. You know what, I said, let's go. I would have done anything, gone anywhere, given up anything to get sober. But he didn't say none of that. You know what he said? He said, you know what, this Thursday night, a week from Thursday night, we're having, me and a few other fellows are having a big book study. We're starting over at Big Bob Sherrill's house. You know where Big Bob lives? I said, yeah, over on Clinton Street. He said, 7 o'clock. He walked away. You know where I was a week from Thursday at 7 o'clock? I was knocking on Big Bob's house. And we sat down and we went through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, six of us, four or five or six of us. And in the process of that that workshop, I asked him, I said, you know, Rex, and I've been around AA now for a better part of 2 years, but I've never done any inventory work. I've never done any of this step work. I said, I was wondering maybe possibly if we find it in your schedule, if you could maybe, if you wasn't doing anything else, maybe, you know, could come over maybe and listen to my fifth step one of these days. And he said, yeah, that'd be great. Week from Saturday, 10 o'clock. I said, we don't have to rush into it. You know where I was a week from Saturday? At 10 o'clock. They took my daughter. She excused herself for the day. Me and my sponsor, we sat down and we shared my life story. Those things I swore I would never, ever share with another human being. Those things that if we made a movie out of them, they might make PG rating. But in my mind, they were rated triple X. In my mind, you know, all that resentment and all of that anger and that frustration and all that inability to cope and all of that that wanting so much just to be forgiven, and that remorse that lingered over those things that I had done. And I sat down and I shared those with him as honestly and as thoroughly as I could. And when we got done, he asked me a simple question: did you leave anything out? I said, no, I don't think so. He said, I'm going to tell you something. If you left something out, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to be calling me or somebody like me and you're going to be coughing them up here in a few days, or you're going to get drunk. So cough it up. And I said, you know what? There's nothing else to cough up. I think I've been as thorough as I possibly can. He said, then are you ready to have God remove from you the things that he finds objectionable? And I said, yes, I am. I think that's why we're here. Isn't that why we go through this process? He said, then let's pray. And I thought, you know what, the book 12 and 12 says, you know, rebellion dogs are every step, you know. And I'm thinking, did he say pray? You know, this guy's not a preacher. Holy cow. He's not a minister. He's not a preacher, rabbi, priest. This guy drives a fork truck down at Ford for crying out loud. You know? And he started praying. He bowed his head right there in front of God and everybody, right in my kitchen, started praying. And I'm looking over my glasses at him like this. I said, look at this, man. And I'm going through, you know, I'm mumbling, I'm going through the motions, you know. And he said what I now know to be the seventh step prayer, you know. And he had my eight step list that he had gleaned from my fourth step and my fifth step. He gave me some advice as to who I should start on. And there I was. I had entered that day on the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous, and now I'm looking at my eighth step ready to embark upon my ninth step, and I'd been with him like 3 hours. That's how quick that process can happen. That's how quickly it happened to me. And he left that afternoon, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what? this guy just prayed in my house, and he's a fork truck driver, for crying out. But the point of the matter is, I did not find the great spirit of this universe, and that's what I refer to as God. I did not find that power greater than me that stands between me and a whiskey bottle through any church, any rabbi, any priest, any minister. I found the God of my understanding from a fork truck driver that happened to work at Ford at the time, who had been lovingly shown this program the same way that Ebbe Thatcher had shown it to Bill Wilson in November in 1934, and how Bill Wilson had lovingly shared it with Dr. Bob Smith some 6 months later, and then those two guys lovingly shared it with Ebbe Thatcher shortly after that, and then the hundreds upon thousands of people that have come subsequent to that, I hope, have gotten sober the same way. The twofold ailment has a twofold bond that holds us together. We share a common problem, and we share a common solution. And that common solution is found in our 12th step. When I got here, I thought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was don't drink and go to meetings, it gets better. I heard that a lot. But the real message of Alcoholics Anonymous is contained in our 12th step, where it simply says, having had a spiritual awakening. How? By going to 600 meetings a week? Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics, practice these principles in our daily affairs. That's the message I hope I have delivered here this evening. That's the reason I drove down here. And I hope I've done a fairly good job of delivering the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless you all, and thank you so much for having me.